Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
So we don't have a recession in our projection that, you know, today that the challenge in some senses is that demand is too strong relative to supply, right? It's both supply and demand, but we have very strong demand.
I guess we could find that comforting. Dr. Philip Swagel is director of the Congressional Budget Office, testifying recently before the House Budget Committee.
Now, of course, as the Fed tightens, we've seen the impact already in financial markets, and wealth is down. And of course, there's always the possibility of of recession.
But he still admits that recession is a possibility.
We don't have that in our projection. But we try to be in the middle of the range of possibilities, and so certainly at one side is the possibility.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Today, as many of you will have seen, President Biden announced a significant new security assistance package for Ukraine to help give the Ukrainians what they need now to deal with the particular nature of the challenge that they face now in southern and eastern Ukraine.
So, Secretary of State Antony Blinken talking about Russia and Ukraine and the war.
And this will enable them to better defend their territory against the Russian onslaught. We're also continuing to work with partners to try to address the crises that Putin's aggression in Ukraine have helped exacerbate or even provoke. Number one on the top of the list is a food security crisis that we're seeing around the world. Already, pre-existing conditions, climate, COVID, and now you add conflict. This has had a profound effect on the ability of a lot of food to get out of what has been a breadbasket for the world, Ukraine, as well as Russia itself, for that matter, causing prices to spike in places where food actually is available, causing shortages in places where it is harder to get at. So we're working very hard on that. I'm happy to come back to that when we have a conversation. But let me just say this. Even as the brutal fighting continues, we already see that President Putin has failed to achieve his broader strategic objectives. Instead of erasing Ukraine's independence, he strengthened it. Instead of asserting Russia's strength, he's undermined it. Instead of dividing weakening the international order, he's actually brought countries closer together to defend it. You all know this very well. This war is not just about Ukraine, even though its principal victims are, of course, Ukrainians. It is an assault as well on the fundamental principles of a rules-based international order, a phrase that we throw around a lot, particularly on 68th Street, but one that really still has meaning, and we find has meaning for countries around the world. They know that these rules, these norms, these standards, these basic principles that we established many, many years ago to try to preserve peace and security actually have been relatively effective in doing that for all of the challenges we've had in matching our ideals to practical realities. And they see these rules as being under assault by Russia and Ukraine as well.
And there are concerns about trade there, but you can't ignore China.
Simply put, we're going to have to be dealing with each other for years and years to come. The question is how most effectively to do that in terms of our interests and our values. One of the things that we believe strongly, and this has been a debate and discussion going on for many years in Washington and New York and in other places, but where we now land, is that we can't rely on Beijing to change its own trajectory. What we can do, and what we're working to do, is to shape the strategic environment around Beijing to advance our positive vision for an open, inclusive international system. As I described last week, summing it up, our plan is focused on three things. Invest, align, compete. Invest in ourselves, something we've gotten away from over many decades. Align with our allies and partners, because our collective weight together has a much greater impact than any of our countries acting alone. When we're dealing with some action or conduct by China that we find objectionable, it's one thing when the United States takes it on alone as 20-25% of world GDP. It's another one we're aligned with partners and allies, and maybe it's 50-60% of world GDP. And then finally compete with China to defend our interests and build our vision for the future. At the same time, as we tried to make clear, we still see important areas of cooperation, and we'll pursue those wherever we can.
And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We live in a great time of disruption caused by a changing climate, a global pandemic, and an unprovoked and brutal war, all of which manifests itself in supply chain disruptions, inflation, unprecedented natural disasters, growing global food insecurity, and continued pandemic-related hospitalizations and deaths.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Added to this litany of challenges, the tragic events recently in New York and Texas, where innocent people shopping at a grocery store and children in school were gunned down. Because we as a nation have not yet summoned the courage to put common sense gun laws in place. Given all of these challenges that the country faces, one might ask, why are we even talking about transforming the American food system? Well, I believe the answer is simple. It's what we always do in America. When faced with grave challenges, America seizes the opportunity to transform itself into a stronger and better form of itself. It is, as President Biden often says, in our nature to build back better. It's why we're emerging from this pandemic with a majority of Americans vaccinated, record job growth, and historically low unemployment. But there's clearly more to do, and a transformed food system is part of what needs to be done.
Vilsack, speaking recently at Georgetown University, rolling out the four tenets of a transformed food system.
I believe there are four basic elements: production, processing, distribution, aggregation, and market development. A transformed food system needs to be one that, through all four elements, sustainably grows and raises commodities and livestock with net zero greenhouse gas emissions, while also raising farm and rural incomes. One that builds greater resilience across the entire food supply chain, provides access to nutritious food for all, and guarantees equity of opportunity for all.
He also addressed organic farming.
You know, as USDA helps to create climate-smart agricultural commodities with reduced greenhouse gas impacts and carbon impacts, there's also a need to invest in and to recognize the importance of organic agricultural production, given its contribution to a sustainable food system. The process for becoming an organic producer is complicated and financially difficult, especially during the early days of transition when expenses can be high and income limited. I believe a transformed food system needs to make that process less complicated and the financial costs of transition easier to bear. So today, I'm announcing a $300 million effort to do just that. Over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, these resources will be used to create a mentoring program where organic beginners can be paired with experienced organic farmers who can provide guidance on how best to navigate and simplify the transition process. Those resources will be used to provide the initial cost of conservation compliance to meet the organic standards and to help expand and develop markets across the United States. Now, this organic transition initiative will build upon the support already provided by USDA under the Organic Certification and Transition Cost Share Program that helps with the cost of organic certification under our National Organic Program. We believe that additional organic agricultural production will hasten the day when our food transform system gets to its net zero emissions future, while also expanding now high-value opportunities for farmers, ranchers, and growers.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Compared to, I'm just thinking about that over the 10-year outlook. The 10-year outlook has gone from, it's just over 12 trillion to over 14.5 trillion.
Dr. Philip Swagel is director of the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, with a stark warning about the deficit.
And so revenue's gone up. So this is, again, looking at it at 10 years. We see this revenue, you know, going up by more than $3.4 trillion. Its outlays go up by more. And part of that is legislation. Part of that is the economic effects, such as higher inflation. And that's what's driving the increased deficits going from 12 trillion to 14.5 trillion over the 10-year horizon.
Dr. Michael Burgess is a member of the House Budget Committee from Texas, asking Dr. Schwagel if tax revenues are stronger.
That's right. That continues to be the case. It's both from the economy is stronger. There's some timing shifts that, you know, the pandemic legislation, you know, delayed some taxes. So we're seeing some of that come back now. You know, even beyond that, tax revenue is strong.
Let me ask you this. When you report a reduction in the deficit, is that largely because the strength of the income tax collections were stronger than what you'd anticipated?
You know, it's a mix that compared to our previous analysis.
Well, how much of that mix was increased tax revenues? We were all told that this was a $1 trillion giveaway to the millionaires and billionaires, according to Chairman Sanders. So what's the deal here?
So I'll tell you, if you compare the projection we made in 2020 for 2022, right? So we're saying it's $1 trillion is what we're saying now. We previously thought it'd be $1.2 trillion, and that's the mix. That revenue is about $400 billion stronger than we anticipated. Spending,
yeah, that's an important number, $400 billion stronger. I mean, that's pretty significant.
Representative Jay Obernold is from California. Is there a train wreck coming?
Let me ask about something Congressman Feenstra mentioned, the trust fund and the declining balances in the trust funds. And you go over that in page 125 and 126 of your outlook. Mm-hmm. You say that the outlook was prepared under the assumption that mandatory spending would continue regardless of the balance in the trust funds. But you also say on the previous page that the government has no legal authority to continue to expend anything when the balance of the trust funds is exhausted, other than the revenue that's coming in. So those two statements are in tension, and I'm wondering, why do we do it that way? Because we're contradicting ourselves, you know, in the span of one page.
No, I agree. There is a tension there, and we are following the budget rules, and in some sense that's why it's tables B1 and B2 around the chapter that you showed. Is trying to provide that information, and it's the Deficit Control Act that requires us to do it that way. And so we're trying to provide as complete information as we can, to follow the law, and then provide the additional information to show the impact of that tension that you mentioned.
All right. Well, I would encourage you to do that in the future. I see my time has expired. But, you know, please, in the previous outlook, you had made plain that just attacking discretionary spending is not going to be sufficient to solve this problem, and that it's vital. Regardless of your political party or political stance, it's going to be vital for us to get this under control. So we're going to have to take a look at those trust funds and what we're going to do as those balances decline and are exhausted. And I'd like to encourage you to please include those scenarios. As uncomfortable as that conversation might be, please include those scenarios in future outlooks.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think it's important to note that just like agricultural producers have never dealt with the SEC, the SEC has, in large part, never dealt with the agricultural industry.
Mary Thomas Hard is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
So I think, you know, there's certainly a gap in understanding, you know, what we have available to report. On top of that, I think this is really a symptom of a larger issue about, you know, shareholders or consumers not understanding the U.S. agricultural industry and the strides that we've made in improving our environmental footprint. I think, you know, telling that story is a huge way to put shareholders at ease so that they don't feel like they need these reports, you know, submitted to the SEC. In the meantime, I think, you know, it's important to continue engaging with the SEC. And just to kind of highlight this again, the direct reporting requirement to the federal government will not be a burden on farmers and ranchers. That is a requirement for publicly traded entities, right, for these publicly traded companies. But those publicly traded companies are going to have to get that information from the supply chain. So I think our concern is that, you know, there is going to be a significant but indirect impact to farmers and ranchers.
Agriculture and the SEC, definitely two strange bedfellows. What happens next?
We have carefully, you know, read through the rule, all 500 pages of the proposed rule. And we have some concerns, and I think that they are, you know, well-rooted in the text of the proposed rule. So, you know, we plan to submit technical comments to the SEC and, one, ask that they eliminate the requirement for Scope 3 supply chain reporting requirement. But if they don't feel comfortable eliminating the requirements entirely, we request that the SEC just use information that's already publicly available. You know, the USDA does life cycle assessments for beef production, for other livestock production, and gives us a pretty good idea of, you know, greenhouse gas emissions per pound of beef. And we think that would be an excellent source that could be used by these companies to show their supply chain emissions. If they weren't comfortable with that option, the EPA does a kind of 30,000-foot industry snapshot every year for their greenhouse gas emissions inventory and tells us that U.S. cattle production is only responsible for 2% of the United States' overall greenhouse gas emissions. We think that that data is also acceptable because it's already in the public domain. It wouldn't require producers to submit any additional information. And so, you know, we think that if the SEC is going to require supply chain reporting, that it be limited to information that's already publicly available. I think the last thing we want is for an agency that clearly has no authority over the agricultural industry to indirectly create a requirement for reporting new information that is really tough to gather, if not impossible.
She says if you want to dig a little deeper or even submit comments, all of that can be done online.
You can even submit comments to the SEC. You can go to policy.ncba.org and submit a comment to SEC Chairman Gensler telling him that the SEC is meant to regulate Wall Street, not Main Street, and talking about the importance of, you know, considering the needs of agricultural producers in finalizing this rule.
Mary Thomas Hart with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In addition to committing targeted resources through the National Conservation Resource Service to incentivize climate-smart agricultural practices and soil health initiatives, the USDA, with the help of farmers, ranchers, and growers, launched the Climate Smart Agriculture and Forestry Commodity Partnership Initiative. This initiative is going to provide $1 billion to accelerate more rapid adoption of climate smart agriculture and forestry practices.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack recently speaking at Georgetown University.
More tools to accurately measure and verify the climate benefits of reduced greenhouse gases and of increases in stored carbon of certain climate smart practices, and more markets through which climate-smart commodities can be sold at a higher value benefiting producers. Now, the response to this initiative has been, I think, overwhelming, with over 450 applications totaling $18 billion in requests on proposed projects across all states and all commodity groups.
He talked about the workforce of the future.
Now, there are two aspects of capacity when we speak of capacity in a transformed food system. There's obviously the physical infrastructure that's necessary to produce the food. There's also the people that are needed to be trained and experienced to do the work. Both aspects require investment. Now, while our country waits for the United States Senate to pass the Farm Worker Modernization Act, USDA intends to move forward to help build a talented workforce. And this is one of a number of initiatives that we'll be announcing in the very near future. As part of the initial investment in a transformed food system, we're going to make $40 million available to work with land-grant universities, community colleges, and minority-serving institutions to support workforce development, starting with the meat and poultry industry. This is a first step in an effort to rebuild the workforce for agriculture.
And the need to target food deserts.
Today, in major cities and remote rural areas, far too many Americans live in food deserts that severely limit their ability to access healthy foods. Many of these food deserts disproportionately limit access for families of color. USDA's Healthy Food Financing Initiative, which focuses on distribution and retail, seeks to ultimately reduce and eliminate food deserts. Today, we take another important step in that effort by announcing a commitment of an additional $155 million that we will invest in our Healthy Food Financing Initiative, which will be aimed at cities and rural communities that are currently poorly served by the current food system, allowing us to begin the process of eliminating food deserts. Now, in addition to the Healthy Food Financing Initiative, we're going to make a set of other investments which we think will also address this issue. For example, we're going to increase by $75 million our efforts in urban agriculture. These are efforts to increase urban agriculture and innovation in food production and composting in 17 major urban centers across the United States. We're going to increase the very highly popular and well-used farm-to-school program with an additional $60 million investment to encourage more local and regional purchases of wholesome foods used in our school meals. We're going to expand by $50 million our senior farmer market nutrition program that's going to expand seniors' access to locally grown fruits and vegetables. And an exciting opportunity is the expansion by $40 million of the GusNIP produce prescription program. This is designed to link our efforts with that of physicians who are literally prescribing fruits and vegetables as remedies for patients who have nutrient-deficient diets.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We serve the Congress. We work for both chambers and both sides. So we're nonpartisan.
Dr. Philip Schwegel is director of the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO.
We work through the budget committees and for the chairs and ranking members of committees of jurisdiction. The baseline update once the budget committees adopt the work as a new baseline, provides a foundation for policymakers to look at the impact of fiscal policy, whether on spending or on revenue. So that's why we do it the way we do it. We try to look ahead under current law as best we can so that you have the foundation on which to evaluate fiscal policy.
Dr. Schwegel also admits that over time, those projections lose their accuracy.
The difficulty, it grows, as we go out over time. And we understand that. We acknowledge that. I mean, even nominal dollars, comparing a dollar in year 10 against a dollar in year one, right? We do it because that's useful to the Congress. But of course, policymakers understand that, 10 years from now is different than this year. The other thing we do also is we keep the baseline, the baseline constant, just so that you have a constant benchmark that, as I said before, right, we know our inflation forecast is too low, right? I mean, we locked it in the beginning of March. Subsequent events showed it was higher. We're still going to keep the baseline, the economic projection constant, so that there's a consistent benchmark to evaluate all proposals, both sides, both chambers. That's the key to what we do, is to be consistent so that, you and your colleagues can evaluate the merits or not of legislation.
Schwegel testifying before the House Budget Committee, where the chairman from Kentucky, John Yarmuth, addressed inflation.
We hear these numbers, 8.3%, the most recent one, your projections for this year a little bit lower than that. And the comment made, it's a $5,000 tax increase for the average family. Well, it really depends on what the average family does and how it's what it's composed of. I mean, the impact of inflation on a family of six or eight is a lot different than the impact on a family of two. Food prices are different. Mm-hmm. At one point, I know that it was estimated that a third of the inflation rate was due to the price of used cars, mm-hmm. the growth. Well, if you're not buying a car, that portion of the inflation rate doesn't affect you. So it's really kind of it's individual circumstances that are going to determine the impact of increased prices on everyone. Now, we know everybody eats and food prices are up, and we have to respond to these as we can. But we generalize because that's what we do. But one of the questions, I know, for instance, everybody's saying, well, the price of eggs are gone up. Well, they had to kill 5 million hens mm-hmm. because of the avian flu. That's not anything had to do with anybody's policy. Right. That was an unfortunate act of nature that resulted in the price of eggs. When the pandemic started, lumber manufacturers stopped producing lumber because they thought there wouldn't be a demand for it. Well, it turns out there was a huge demand for it. They weren't supplying it. The price of lumber went up five or six times. Now it's come back down to about a third of its highest level. But all of these components make it really difficult to figure out what happened, to cause the inflation, but also to deal with it. Because a lot of it's the actual marketplace and decisions that producers made, the shipment of computer chips and so forth impacted a lot.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As far as getting the spring wheat planted,
we did break out of the basement in terms of planting by late May.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says growers last week got 24% of the crop planted. So as we start the week, 73% of the crop is in the ground, 42% emerged. The average emergence, though, is 69%. Now for the beleaguered winter wheat crop, Rippey says some rain did fall on that crop in the central and southern plains this week.
Too late to revive the crop. And so we are looking at a crop that is going to end as one of the lower tier rated crops of the 21st century.
Right now, rated 40% poor to very poor, and in the Great Plains states,
all seven of the reporting states in the Great Plains reporting winter wheat that is at least one quarter very poor to poor, with the crop getting worse as you move southward.
For example, in Montana, 26% of the winter wheat's rated poor to very poor. By the time you hit Texas, it's up to 80%. Gary Crawford, Washington.